Tyrion. By the time they reached Volantis, the sky was purple to the west and black to the east, and the stars were coming out. "The same stars as in Westeros," Tyrion Lannister reflected. He might have taken some comfort in that if he had not been trussed up like a goose and lashed to a saddle. He had given up squirming. The knots that bound him were too tight. Instead, he'd gone as limp as a sack of meal. "Saving my strength," he told himself, though for what he could not have said. Volantis closed its gates at dark, and the guardsmen on the northern gate were grumbling impatiently at the stragglers. They joined the queue behind a wagon laden with limes and oranges. The guards motioned the wagon through with their torches, but took a harder look at the big Andal on his war horse, with his long sword in his mail. A captain was summoned. Whilst he and the knight exchanged some words in Volantine, one of the guardsmen pulled off his clawed gauntlet and gave Tyrion's head a rub. "I'm full of good fortune," the dwarf told him. "Cut me loose, friend, and I'll see you're well rewarded." His captor overheard. "Save your lawyers for those who speak your tongue, imp," he said when the Volantines waved them on. Then they were moving again, through the gate and beneath the city's massive walls. "You speak my tongue? Can I sway you with promises, or are you determined to buy a lordship with my head?"
"I was a lord, by right of birth. I want no hollow titles. That's all you're likely to get from my sweet sister. And here I've heard a Lannister always pays his debts."
"Oh, every penny, but never a groat more, my lord. You'll get the meal you bargain for, but it won't be sourced with gratitude, and in the end it will not nourish you."
"Might be all I want is to see you pay for crimes. The king there is accursed in the eyes of gods and men."
"The gods are blind, and men only see what they wish."
"I see you plain enough, imp."
Something dark had crept into the knight's tone.
"I've done things I'm not proud of, things that brought shame unto my house and my father's name. But to kill your own sire, how could any man do that?"
"Give me a crossbow and pull down your breeches, and I'll show you, gladly."
"You think this is a jape?"
I think life is a jape. Yours, mine, everyone's." Inside the city walls, they rode past guild halls, markets, and bathhouses. Fountains splashed and sang in the centres of wide squares where men sat at stone tables, moving Syvas pieces and sipping wine from glass flutes, as slaves lit ornate lanterns to hold the dark at bay. Palms and cedars grew along the cobbled road, and monuments stood at every junction. Many of the statues lacked heads, the dwarf noted, yet even headless they still managed to look imposing in the purple dusk. As the warhorse plodded south along the river, the shops grew smaller and meaner. The trees along the street became a row of stumps. Cobblestones gave way to devil grass beneath their horses' hooves, then to soft wet mud, the colour of baby's night soil. The little bridges that spanned the small streams that fed the Roine creaked alarmingly beneath their weight. Where a fort had once overlooked the river stood a broken gate, gaping open like an old man's toothless mouth. Goats could be glimpsed, peering over the parapets. "Old Volantis, first daughter of Valeria," the dwarf mused. "Proud Volantis, queen of the Roine and mistress of the summer sea, home to noble lords and lovely ladies of the most ancient blood. Never mind the packs of naked children that roam the alleys screaming in shrill voices, or the bravos standing at the doors of wine shops fingering their sword hilts, or the slaves with their bent backs and tattooed faces who scurried everywhere like cockroaches. Mighty Volantis, grandest and most populous of the nine free cities." Ancient wars had depopulated much of the city, however, and large areas of Volantis had begun to sink back into the mud
on which it stood. Beautiful Volantis, city of fountains and flowers. But half the fountains were dry, half the pools cracked and stagnant. Flowering vines sent up creepers from every crack in wall or pavement, and young trees had taken root in the walls of abandoned shops and roofless temples. And then there was the smell. It hung in the hot, humid air, rich, rank, pervasive. There's fish in it, and flowers, and some elephant dung as well. Something sweet, and something earthy, and something dead and rotten. This city smells like an old whore, Tyrion announced, like some sagging slattern who has drenched her privy parts in perfume to drown the stench between her legs. Not that I am complaining. With whores, the young ones smell much better, but the old ones no more tricks. You would know more of that than I do. Oh, of course, that brothel where we met. Did you take it for a sept? Was that your virgin sister squirming in your lap? That made him scowl. Give that tongue of yours a rest, unless you'd rather I tied it in a knot. Tyrion swallowed his retort. His lip was still fat and swollen than the last time he had pushed the big knight too far. Hard hands and no sense of humour makes for a bad marriage. That much he'd learned on the road from Selhoris. His thoughts went to his boot, to the mushrooms in his toe. His captor had not searched him quite as thoroughly as he might have. There is always that escape. Cersei would not have me alive, at least. Farther south, signs of prosperity began to reappear. Abandoned buildings were seen less often. The naked children vanished. The bravos in the doorways seemed more sumptuously dressed. A few of the inns they passed actually looked like places where a man might sleep, without fear of having his throat slit. Lanterns swung from iron stanchions along the river road, swaying when the wind blew. The streets grew broader, the buildings more imposing. Some were topped with great domes of coloured glass. In the gathering dusk, with fires lit beneath them, the domes glowed blue and red and green and purple. Even so, there was something in the air that made Tyrion uneasy. West of the Roine, he knew, the wharfs of Volantis teemed with sailors, slaves, and traders, and the wine shops, inns, and brothels all catered to them. East of the river, strangers from across the seas were seen less seldom. "We are not wanted here," the dwarf realized. The first time they passed an elephant, Tyrion could not help but stare. There had been an elephant in the menagerie at Lannisport when he had been a boy, but she had died when he was 7, and this great grey behemoth looked to be twice her size. Farther on they fell in behind a smaller elephant, white as old bone, and pulling an ornate cart. "Is an ox cart without an ox?" Tyrion asked his captor. When that sally got no response, he lapsed back into silence, contemplating the rolling rump of the white dwarf elephant ahead of them. Volantis was overrun with white dwarf elephants. As they drew closer to the Black Wall and the crowded districts near the Long Bridge, they saw a dozen of them. Big grey elephants were not uncommon either. Huge beasts, with castles on their backs. And in the half-light of evening, the dung carts had come out, attended by half-naked slaves, whose task it was to shovel up the steaming piles left by elephants both great and small. Swarms of flies followed their carts, so the dung slaves had flies tattooed upon their cheeks, to mark them for what they were. "There's a trade for my sweet sister," Tyrion mused. "She'd look so pretty with the little shovel and flies tattooed on those sweet pink cheeks." By then they had slowed to a crawl. The river road was thick with traffic, almost all of it flowing south. The knight went with it, a log caught in a current. Tyrion eyed the passing throngs. 9 men of every 10 bore slave marks on their cheeks. So many slaves. Where are they all going? The Red Priests light their night fires at sunset. The High Priest will be speaking. I would avoid it if I could, but to reach the Long Bridge we must pass the Red Temple. 3 blocks later, the street opened up before them onto a huge torch-lit plaza, and there it stood. 7 save me. That's got to be 3 times the size of the great Sept of Baelor. An enormity of pillars, steps, buttresses, bridges, domes, and towers, flowing into one another as if they had all been chiseled from one colossal rock. The Temple of the Lord of Light loomed like Aegon's High Hill. 100 hues of red, yellow, gold, and orange met and melded into the temple walls, dissolving one into the other like clouds at sunset. Its slender towers twisted ever upwards, frozen flames dancing as they reached for the sky. Fire turned to stone. Huge night fires burned beside the temple steps, and between them the High Priest had begun to speak. Benero! The priest stood atop a red stone pillar, joined by a slender stone bridge to a lofty terrace where the lesser priests and acolytes stood. The acolytes were clad in robes of pale yellow and bright orange, priests and priestesses in red. The great plaza before them was packed almost solid. Many and more of the worshippers were wearing some scrap of red cloth, pinned to their sleeves or tied around their brows. Every eye was on the High Priest, save theirs. "Make way," the knight growled, as his horse pushed through the throng. "Clear a path." The Volantines gave way resentfully, with mutters and angry looks. Benero's high voice carried well. Tall and thin, he had a drawn face and skin as white as milk. Flames had been tattooed across his cheeks and chin and shaven head to make a bright red mask that crackled about his eyes and coiled down and around his lipless mouth. "Is that a sleeve tattoo?" asked Tyrion. The knight nodded. "The Red Temple buys them as children and makes them priests or temple prostitutes or warriors. Look there." He pointed at the steps, where a line of men in ornate armor and orange cloaks stood before the temple's doors, clasping spears with points like writhing flames. "The Fiery Hand, the Lord of Light's sacred soldiers, defenders of the temple." "Fire Knights. And how many fingers does this hand have, pray?"
1,000, never more, never less. A new flame is kindled for everyone that gutters out."
Benero jabbed a finger at the moon, made a fist, spread his hands wide. When his voice rose up in a crescendo, flames leapt from his fingers with a sudden whoosh and made the crowd gasp. The priest could trace fiery letters in the air as well. "Valerian glyphs?" Tyrion recognized perhaps 2 in 10. One was doom, the other darkness. Shouts erupted from the crowd. Women were weeping, and men were shaking their fists. "I have a bad feeling about this." The dwarf was reminded of the day Marcella sailed for Dawn, and the riot that boiled up as they made their way back to the Red Keep. Holden Halfmaester had spoken of using the Red Priest to young Griff's advantage, Tyrion recalled. Now that he had seen and heard the man himself, that struck him as a very bad idea. He hoped that Griff had better sense. "Some allies are more dangerous than enemies, but Lord Cunnington will need to puzzle that one out for himself. I am like to be a head on a spike." The priest was pointing at the black wall behind the temple, gesturing up at its parapets where a handful of armored guardsmen stood gazing down. "What is he saying?" Tyrion asked the knight. "The Daenerys stands in peril. The Dark Eye has fallen upon her, and the minions of night are plotting her destruction, praying to their false gods in temples of deceit, conspiring at betrayal with godless outlanders." The hairs on the back of Tyrion's neck
began to prickle. Prince Aegon will find no friend here. The Red Priest spoke of ancient prophecy, a prophecy that foretold the coming of a hero to deliver the world from darkness. One hero, not two. Daenerys has dragons. Aegon does not. The dwarf did not need to be a prophet himself to foresee how Bernero and his followers might react to a second Targaryen. Griff will see that too, surely, he thought, surprised to find how much he cared. The night had forced their way through most of the press at the back of the plaza, ignoring the curses that were flung at them as they passed. One man stepped in front of them, but his captor gripped the hilt of his longsword and drew it just far enough to show a foot of naked steel. The man melted away, and all at once an alley opened up before them. The knight urged his mount to a trot, and they left the crowd behind them. For a while Tyrion could still hear Bernero's voice, growing fainter at their back, and the roars his words provoked, sudden as thunder. They came upon a stable. The knight dismounted, then hammered on the door until a haggard slave, with a horse head on his cheek, came running. The dwarf was pulled down roughly from the saddle and lashed to a post, whilst his captor woke the stable's owner and haggled with him over the price of his horse and saddle. "Cheaper to sell a horse than to ship one half across the world." Tyrion sensed a ship in his immediate future. Perhaps he was a prophet after all. When the dickering was done, the knight slung his weapon, shield, and saddlebag over his shoulder and asked for directions to the nearest smithy. That proved shuttered too, but opened quick enough at the knight's shout. The smith gave Tyrion a squint, then nodded and accepted a fistful of coins. "Come here," the knight told his prisoner. He drew his dagger and slit Tyrion's bonds apart. "My thanks," said Tyrion as he rubbed his wrists. But the knight only laughed and said, "Save your gratitude for someone who deserves it, imp. You will not like this next bit." He was not wrong. The manacles were black iron, thick and heavy, each weighing a good 2 pounds, if the dwarf was any judge. The chains added even more weight. "I must be more fearsome than I knew," Tyrion confessed, as the last links were hammered closed. Each blow sent a shock up his arm, almost to the shoulder. "Or were you afraid that I would dash away on these stinted little legs of mine?" The ironsmith did not so much as look up from his work, but the knight chuckled darkly. "It's your mouth that concerns me, not your legs. In fetters or a slave, no one will listen to a word you say, not even those who speak the tongue of Westeros." "There is no need for this," Tyrion protested. "I will be a good little prisoner. I will, I will." "Prove it, then, and shut your mouth." So he bowed his head and bit his tongue as the chains were fixed, wrist to wrist, wrist to ankle, ankle to ankle. "These bloody things weigh more than I do." Still, at least, he drew breath. His captor could just as easily have cut his head off. That was all Cersei required, after all. Not striking it off straight away had been his captor's first mistake. "There is half a world between Volantis and King's Landing, and much and more can happen along the way, sir." The rest of the way they went by foot, Tyrion clanking and clattering as he struggled to keep up with his captor's long, impatient strides. Whenever he threatened to fall behind, the knight would seize his fetters and yank them roughly, sending the dwarf stumbling and hopping along beside him. "It could be worse. He could be urging me along with a whip." Valanta straddled one mouth of the Roine, where the river kissed the sea, its two halves joined by the long bridge. The oldest, richest part of the city was east of the river, but sellswords, barbarians, and other uncouth outlanders were not welcome there, so they must needs cross over to the west. The gateway to the long bridge was a black stone arch, carved with sphinxes,
manacores, dragons, and creatures stranger still. Beyond the arch stretched the great span that the Valerians had built at the height of their glory, its few stone roadway supported by massive piers. The road was just wide enough for two carts to pass abreast, so whenever a wagon headed west passed one going east, both had to slow to a crawl. It was well they were afoot. A third of the way out, a wagon laden with melons had gotten its wheels tangled with one piled high with silken carpets, and brought all wheeled traffic to a halt. Much of the foot traffic had stopped as well, to watch the drivers curse and scream at one another, but the knight grabbed hold of Tyrion's chain and bulled a path through the throng for both of them. In the middle of the press, a boy tried to reach into his purse, but a hard elbow put an end to that and spread the thief's bloody nose across half his face. Buildings rose to either side of them, shops and temples, taverns and inns, sivas, parlours and brothels. Most were three or four stories tall, each floor overhanging the one beneath it. Their top floors almost kissed. Crossing the bridge felt like passing through a torch-lit tunnel. Along the span were shops and stalls of every sort. Weavers and lace-makers displayed their wares, cheek by jowl with glass-blowers, candle-makers, and fishwives selling eels and oysters. Each goldsmith had a guard at his door, and every spicer had two, for their goods were twice as valuable. Here and there, between the shops, a traveller might catch a glimpse of the river he was crossing. To the north, the Roine was a broad black ribbon bright with stars, five times as wide as the Blackwater Rush at King's Landing. South of the bridge, the river opened up to embrace the briny sea. At the bridge's centre span, the severed hands of thieves and cutpurses hung like strings of onions from iron stanchions along the roadway. Three heads were on display as well, two men and a woman, their crimes scrawled on tablets underneath them. A pair of spearmen attended them, clad in polished helms and shirts of silver mail. Across their cheeks were tiger stripes as green as jade. From time to time the guards waved their spears to chase away the kestrels, gulls, and carrion crows paying court to the deceased. The birds returned to the heads within moments. "What did they do?" Tyrion inquired innocently. The knight glanced at the inscriptions. "The woman was a slave who raised her hand to her mistress. The older man was accused of fomenting rebellion and spying for the Dragon Queen. And the young one killed his father." Tyrion gave the rotting head a second look. "Why, it almost looks as if those lips are smiling." Farther on, the knight paused briefly to consider a jewel tiara displayed upon a bed of purple velvet. He passed that by, but a few steps on, he stopped again to haggle over a pair of gloves at a leather worker's stall. Tyrion was grateful for the respites. The headlong pace had left him puffing, and his wrists were chafed raw from the manacles. From the far end of the long bridge, it was only a short walk through the teeming waterfront districts of the West Bank, down torchlit streets, crowded with sailors, slaves, and drunken merrymakers. Once an elephant lumbered past with a dozen half-naked slave girls waving from the castle on its back, teasing passers-by with glimpses of their breasts. "Malaquo! Malaquo!" They made such an entrancing sight that Tyrion almost waddled right into the steaming pile of dung the elephant had left to mark its passage. He was saved at the last instant when the knight snatched him aside, yanking on his chain so hard it made him reel and stumble. "How much farther?" the dwarf asked. "Just there, Fishmonger Square." Their destination proved to be the merchant's house, a four-story monstrosity that squatted amongst the warehouses, brothels, and taverns of the waterside like some enormous fat man surrounded by children. its common room was larger than the great halls of half the castles in Westeros, a dim-lit maze of a place with 100 private alcoves and hidden nooks, whose blackened beams and cracked ceilings echoed to the din of sailors, traders, captains, money-changers, shippers, and slavers lying, cursing, and cheating each other in 50 different tongues. Tyrion approved the choice of hostelry. Soon or late, the shy maid must reach Volantis. This was the city's biggest inn, first choice for shippers, captains, and merchantmen. A lot of business was done in that cavernous warren of a common room. He knew enough of Volantis to know that. Let Griff turn up here with Duck and Holden, and he would be free again soon enough. Meanwhile, he would be patient. His chance would come. The rooms upstairs proved rather less than grand, however, particularly the cheap ones up on the fourth floor. Wedged into a corner of the building beneath a sloping roof, the bedchamber his captor had engaged featured a low ceiling, a sagging feather bed with an unpleasant odour, and a slanting wood plank floor that reminded Tyrion of his sojourn at the Eyrie. At least this room has walls. It had windows, too. Those were its chief amenity, along with the iron ring set in the wall, so useful for chaining up one's slaves. His captor paused only long enough to light a tallow candle before securing Tyrion's chains to the ring. "Must you?" the dwarf protested, rattling feebly. "Where am I going to go? Out the window?"
"You might."
"We are four floors up, and I cannot fly."
"You can fall. I want you alive."
"Aye, but why, Cersei is not like to care." Tyrion rattled his chains. "I know who you are, sir." It had not been hard to puzzle out. The bear in his surcoat, the arms in his shield, the lost lordship he had mentioned. "I know what you are, and if you know who I am, you also know that I was the king's hand, and sat in council with the spider. Would it interest you to know that it was the eunuch who dispatched me on this journey? Him and Jamie, but I'll leave my brother out of it. I am as much his creature as you are. We ought not to be at odds." That did not please the knight. "I took the spider's coin, I'll not deny it, but I was never his creature, and my loyalties lie elsewhere now. With Cersei? Oh, more fool you. All my sister requires is my head, and you have a fine sharp sword. Why not end this farce now, and spare us both?" The knight laughed. "Is this some dwarf's trick? Beg for death, in hopes I'll let you live?" He went to the door. "I'll bring you something from the kitchens." "How kind of you. I'll wait here."
"I know you will."
Yet when the knight left, he locked the door behind him with a heavy iron key. The merchant's house was famous for its locks. As secure as a jail, the dwarf thought bitterly. But at least there are those windows. Tyrion knew that the chances of his escaping his chains were little and less, but even so, he felt obliged to try. His efforts to slip a hand through the manacle served only to scrape off more skin and leave his wrist slick with blood, and all his tugging or twisting could not pull the iron ring from the wall. "Bugger this," he thought, slumping back as far as his chains would allow. His legs had begun to cramp. This was going to be a hellishly uncomfortable night. "The first of many, I do not doubt." The room was stifling, so the knight had opened the shutters to let in a cross breeze. Cramped into a corner of the building under the eaves, the chamber was fortunate in having two windows. One looked toward the long bridge and the black-walled heart of old Volantis across the river. The other opened on the square below. Fishermonger's Square, Mormont called it. As tight as the chains were, Tyrion found he could see out of the latter by leaning sideways and letting the iron ring support his weight. Not as long a fall as the one from Lysa Arryn's sky cells, but it would leave me just as dead. Perhaps if I were drunk. Even at this hour, The square was crowded, with sailors roistering, whores prowling for custom, and merchants going about their business. A red priestess scurried past, attended by a dozen acolytes with torches, their robes whisking about their ankles. Elsewhere, a pair of Saivas players waged war outside a tavern. A slave stood beside their table, holding a lantern over the board. Tyrion could hear a woman singing. The words were strange. The tune was soft and sad. If I knew what she was singing, I might cry. Closer to hand, a crowd was gathering around a pair of jugglers throwing flaming torches at each other. His captor returned shortly, carrying two tankards and a roasted duck. He kicked the door shut, ripped the duck in two, and tossed half of it to Tyrion. He would have snatched it from the air, but his chains brought him up short when he tried to lift his arms. Instead, the bird struck his temple and slid, hot and greasy, down his face. And he had to hunker down and stretch for it with fetters clanking. He got it on the third try and happily tore into it with his teeth. "Some ale to wash this down?" Mormont handed him a tankard. "Most of Valantis is getting drunk, why not you?" The ale was sweet as well. It tasted of fruit. Tyrion drank a healthy swallow and belched happily. The tankard was pewter, very heavy. "Empty it and fling it at his head," he thought. "If I am lucky, it might crack his skull. If I am very lucky, it will miss, and he'll beat me to death with his fists." He took another gulp. "Is this some holy day?"
"Third day of their elections. They last for 10 days of madness. Torchlight marches, speeches, mummers and minstrels and dancers, bravos fighting death duels for the honour of their candidates, elephants with the names of would-be triarchs painted on their sides. Those jugglers are performing for Methiso."
"Remind me to vote for someone else." Tyrion licked grease from his fingers. Below, the crowd was flinging coins at the jugglers.
"Do all these would-be triarchs provide mama shows?"
"They do whatever they think will win them votes," said Mormont. "Food, drink, spectacle. Alias has sent 100 pretty slave girls out into the streets to lay with voters."
"I'm for him," Tyrion decided. "Bring me a slave girl. They're for freeborn volunteers with enough property to vote. Precious few voters west of the river." "And this goes on for 10 days?
Tyrion laughed.
I might enjoy that, though 3 kings is too many. I am trying to imagine ruling the 7 kingdoms with my sweet sister and brave brother beside me. One of us would kill the other 2 inside a year. I am surprised these triarchs don't do the same."
"If you have tried, might be the Volantines are the clever ones, and us Westerosi the fools. Valantis has known her share of follies, but she's never suffered a boy triarch. Whenever a madman's been elected, his colleagues restrain him until his year has run its course. Think of the dead who might still live if mad Ares only had 2 fellow kings to share the rule."
"Instead, he had my father," Tyrion thought. "Some of the free cities think that we're all savages on our side of the Narrow Sea," the knight went on. "The others think that we're children, crying out for a father's strong hand."
"Or a mother's?" "Cersei will love that, especially when he presents her with my head."
"You seem to know this city well."
"I spent the best part of a year here."
The knight sloshed the dregs at the bottom of his tankard. "When Stark drove me into exile, I fled to Lys with my 2nd wife. Braavos would have suited me better, but Lyonis wanted some place warm. Instead of serving the Braavosi, I fought them on the Roine, but for every silver I earned, my wife spent 10. By the time I got back to Lys, she had taken a lover, who told me cheerfully that I would be enslaved for debt unless I gave her up and left the city. That was how I came to Valantis. 1 step ahead of slavery, owning nothing but my sword and the clothes upon my back. And now you want to run home?" The knight drained the last of his ale. On the morrow, I'll find us a ship. The bed is mine. You can have whatever piece of floor your chains will let you reach. Sleep, if you can. If not, count your crimes. That should see you through till the morning.
You have your crimes to answer for, Jorah Mormont, the dwarf thought, but it seemed wiser to keep that thought to himself. Sir Jorah hung his sword belt on a bedpost, kicked off his boots, pulled his chainmail over his head, and stripped out of his wool and leather and sweat-stained undertunic to reveal a scarred, brawny torso covered with dark hair.
"If I could skin him, I could sell that pelt for a fur coat," Tyrion thought, as Mormont tumbled into the slightly smelly comfort of his sagging feather bed.
In no time at all, the knight was snoring, leaving his prize alone with his chains. With both windows open wide, the light of the waning moon spilled across the bedchamber. Sounds drifted up from the square below, snatches of drunken song, the yowling of a cat in heat, the far-off ring of steel on steel. "Someone's about to die," thought Tyrion. His wrist was throbbing where he'd torn the skin, and his fetters made it impossible for him to sit, let alone stretch out. The best he could do was twist sideways to lean against the wall, and before long he began to lose all feeling in his hands. When he moved to relieve the strain, sensation came flooding back as pain. He had to grind his teeth to keep from screaming. He wondered how much his father had hurt when the quarrel punched through his groin, what Shay had felt as he twisted the chain around her lying throat, what Taisha had been feeling as they raped her. His sufferings were nothing compared to their own, but that did not make him hurt any less.
"Just make it stop."
Sir Jorah had rolled onto one side, so all that Tyrion could see of him was a broad, hairy, muscular back.
"Even if I could slip these chains, I'd need to climb over him to reach his sword belt. Perhaps if I could ease the dagger loose..."
Or else he could try for the key, unlock the door, creep down the stairs and through the common room.
"And go where? I have no friends, no coin. I do not even speak the local tongue."
Exhaustion finally overwhelmed his pains, and Tyrion drifted off into a fitful sleep. But every time another cramp took root inside his calf and twisted, the dwarf would cry out in his sleep, trembling in his chains. He woke with every muscle aching to find morning streaming through the windows, bright and golden as the Lion of Lannister. Below he could hear the cries of fishmongers and the rumble of iron-rimmed wheels on cobblestones. Jorah Mormont was standing over him.
"If I take off the ring, will you do as you're told?"
"Will it involve dancing? I might find dancing difficult. I cannot feel my legs. They may have fallen off. Elsewise, I am your creature, on my honour as a Lannister."
"The Lannisters have no honour."
Sir Jorah loosed his chains anyway. Tyrion took two wobbly steps and fell. The blood rushing back into his hands brought tears to his eyes. He bit his lip and said,
"Wherever we're going, you will need to roll me there."
Instead, the big knight carried him, hoisting him by the chain between his wrists. The common room of the merchant's house was a dim labyrinth of alcoves and grottos built around a central courtyard where a trellis of flowering vines threw intricate patterns across the flagstone floor, and green and purple moss grew between the stones. Slave girls scurried through light and shadow, bearing flagons of ale and wine and some ice-green drink that smelled of mint. One table in 20 was occupied at this hour of the morning. One of those was occupied by a dwarf, clean-shaven and pink-cheeked, with a mop of chestnut hair, a heavy brow, and a squash nose. He perched on a high stool with a wooden spoon in his hand, contemplating a bowl of purplish gruel with red-rimmed eyes.
Ugly little bastard, Tyrion thought. The other dwarf felt his stare. When he raised his head and saw Tyrion, the spoon slipped from his hand. He saw me, Tyrion warned Mormont.
What of it?
He knows me, who I am.
Should I stuff you in a sack, so no one will see you?
The knight touched the hilt of his longsword. If he means to try and take you, he is welcome to try. Welcome to die, you mean, thought Tyrion. What threat could he pose to a big man like you? He's only a dwarf. Ser Jorah claimed a table in a quiet corner and ordered food and drink. They broke their fast with warm, soft flatbread, pink fish roe, honey sausage, and fried locust, washed down with a bittersweet black ale. Tyrion ate like a man half-starved.
You have a healthy appetite this morning, the knight observed.
I've heard the food in hell is wretched. Tyrion glanced at the door where a man had just come in. Tall and stooped, his pointed beard was dyed a splotchy purple. Some Tyrushi trader. A gust of sound came with him from outside. The cries of gulls, a woman's laughter, the voices of the fishmongers. For half a heartbeat, he thought he glimpsed Illyrio Mopatis. But it was only one of those white dwarf elephants passing the front door. Mormont spread some fish roe across a slice of flatbread and took a bite.
Are you expecting someone?
Tyrion shrugged. You never know who the wind might blow in. My one true love, my father's ghost, a duck. He popped a locust into his mouth and crunched it.
Not bad. For a bug.
Last night the talk here was all of Westeros. Some exiled lord has hired the Golden Company to win back his lands for him. Half the captains in Volantis are racing upriver to Volantheris to offer him their ships. Tyrion had just swallowed another locust. He almost choked on it. Is he mucking me? How much could he know of Griffin Aegon? Bugger, he said. I meant to hire Golden Company myself to win me Casterly Rock. Could this be some ploy of Griff's? False reports deliberately spread? Unless... Could the pretty princeling have swallowed the bait? Turn them west instead of east, abandoning his hopes of wedding Queen Daenerys? Abandoning the dragons? Would Griff allow that? I'd gladly hire you as well, sir. My father's seat is mine by rights. Swear me your sword, and once I win it back, I'll drown you in gold. I saw a man drowned in gold once. It was not a pretty sight. If you ever get my sword, it will be through your bowels. A sure cure for constipation, said Tyrion. Just ask my father. He reached for his tankard and took a slow swallow to help conceal whatever might be showing on his face. It had to be a stratagem, designed to lull Volantine's suspicions. Get the men aboard with this false pretext, and seize the ships when the fleet is out to sea. Is that Griff's plan? It might work. The Golden Company was 10,000 strong, seasoned and disciplined. None of them seamen, though. Griff will need to keep a sword at every throat, and should they come on Slaver's Bay and need to fight... The serving girl returned.
The widow will see you next, noble sir. Have you brought a gift for her?
Yes, thank you. Ser Jorah slipped a coin into the girl's palm and sent her on her way. Tyrion frowned. Whose widow is this? The widow of the waterfront, east of the Roine. They still call her Vogaro's whore, though never to her face. The dwarf was not enlightened. And Vogaro was?
An elephant. Seven times a triarch. Very rich. A power on the docks. Whilst other men built the ships and sailed them, he built piers and storehouses, brokered cargoes, changed money, insured ship owners against the hazards of the sea. He dealt in slaves as well. When he grew besotted with one of them,
a bed slave trained at Yonkai in the way of seven sighs. It was a great scandal, and a greater scandal when he freed her and took her for his wife. After he died, she carried on his ventures. No freedman may dwell within the Black Wall, so she was compelled to sell Volgari's Mints. She took up residence at the Merchant's House. That was 32 years ago, and she remains here to this day. That's her behind you, back by the courtyard, holding court at her customary table. No, don't look. There's someone with her now. When he's done, it will be our turn. And this old harridan will help you? How? Sir Jorah stood. Watch and see. He's leaving. Tyrion hopped down off his chair with a rattle of iron. This should be enlightening. There was something vulpine about the way the woman sat in her corner by the courtyard, something reptilian about her eyes. Her white hair was so thin that the pink of her scalp showed through. Under one eye she still bore faint scars where a knife had cut away her tears. The remnants of her morning meal littered the table, sardine heads, olive pits, chunks of flatbread. Tyrion did not fail to note how well chosen her customary table was. Solid stone at her back, a leafy alcove to one side for entrances and exits, a perfect view of the inn's front door, yet so steeped in shadow that she herself was nigh invisible. The sight of him made the old woman smile. "A dwarf," she purred, in a voice as sinister as it was soft. She spoke the common tongue with only a trace of accent.
"Valantis has been overrun with dwarfs of late, it seems. Does this one do tricks?"
"Yes," Tyrion wanted to say. "Give me a crossbow, and I'll show you my favourite."
No, Sir Jorah answered.
"A pity. I once had a monkey who could perform all sorts of clever tricks. Your dwarf reminds me of him. Is he a gift?"
No, I brought you these."
Sir Jorah produced his pair of gloves and slapped them down on the table beside the other gifts the widow had received this morning. A silver goblet, an ornate fan carved of jade leaves, so thin they were translucent, and an ancient bronze dagger marked with runes. Besides such treasures, the gloves looked cheap and tawdry.
"Gloves for my poor old wrinkled hands. How nice."
The widow made no move to touch them.
"I bought them on the Long Bridge."
"A man can buy most anything on the Long Bridge. Gloves, slaves, monkeys."
The years had bent her spine and put a crone's hump upon her back. But the widow's eyes were bright and black.
"Now tell this old widow how she may be of service to you."
"We need swift passage east to Meereen."
One word, Tyrion Lannister's world turned upside down. One word, Meereen. Or had he misheard? One word,
Meereen. He said Meereen. He's taking me to Meereen.
Meereen meant life, or hope for life at least.
"Why come to me?" the widow said. "I own no ships."
"You have many captains in your debt."
"Deliver me to the queen," he says. "Aye, but which queen? He isn't selling me to Cersei. He's giving me to Daenerys Targaryen. That's why he hasn't hacked my head off. We're going east, and Griff and his prince are going west, the bloody fools."
Oh, it was all too much. Plots within plots, but all roads lead down the dragon's gullet. A guffaw burst from his lips, and suddenly Tyrion could not stop laughing.
"Your dwarf is having a fit,"
the widow observed.
"My dwarf will be quiet, or I'll see him gagged."
Tyrion covered his mouth with his hands.
"Meereen."
The widow of the waterfront decided to ignore him.
"Shall we have a drink?"
she asked. Dust motes floated in the air as a serving girl filled two green glass cups for Sir Jorah and the widow. Tyrion's throat was dry, but no cup was poured for him. The widow took a sip, rolled the wine around her mouth, swallowed.
All the other exiles are sailing west, or so these old ears have heard. And all those captains in my debt are falling over one another to take them there, and leech a little gold from the coffers of the Golden Company. Our noble triarchs have pledged a dozen warships to the cause, to see the fleet safely as far as the Stepstones. Even old Doniphus has given his assent. Such a glorious adventure. And yet you would go the other way, sir.
My business is in the East.
And what business is that, I wonder? Not slaves. The Silver Queen has put an end to that. She has closed the fighting pits as well, so it cannot be a taste for blood. What else could Meereen offer to a Westerosi knight? Bricks? Olives? Dragons? Ah, there it is.
The old woman's smile turned feral.
I've heard it said that the Silver Queen feeds them with the flesh of infants, while she herself bathes in the blood of virgin girls and takes a different lover every night.
Sir Jorah's mouth had hardened. The Yunkai are pouring poison in your ears. My lady should not believe such filth.
Oh, I'm no lady, but even Volgari's whore knows the taste of falsehood. This much is true, though. The Dragon Queen has enemies, Yunkai, Nugis, Tollis, Garth, aye, and Valantis soon enough. You would travel to Meereen. Just wait a while, sir. Swords will be wanted soon enough when the warships bend their oars eastwards to bring down the Silver Queen. Tigers love to bare their claws, and even elephants will kill if threatened. Malaquo hungers for a taste of glory, and Nisus owes much of his wealth to the slave trade. Let Alios or Paquello or Belicho gain the triarchy, and the fleets will sail.
Sir Jorah scowled. If Doniphos is returned,
Volgaro will be returned first, and my sweet lord has been dead these 30 years.
Behind them some sailor was bellowing loudly.
They call this ale? Fuck! A monkey could piss better ale.
And you would drink it? Another voice replied. Tyrion twisted round for a look, hoping against hope that it was Duck and Holden he was hearing. Instead, he saw two strangers, and the dwarf, who was standing a few feet away, staring at him intently. He seemed somehow familiar. The widow sipped daintily at her wine.
Some of the first elephants were women, she said. The ones who brought the tigers down and ended the old wars. Triana was returned 4 times. That was 300 years ago, alas. Valantis has had no female triarch since, though some women have the vote. Women of good birth who dwell in ancient palaces behind the black walls, not creatures such as me. The old blood will have their dogs and children voting before any freedmen. No, it will be Belicho, or perhaps Alios. But either way, it will be war, or so they think.
And what do you think? Sir Jorah asked.
Good, thought Tyrion. The right question. Oh, I think it will be war as well, but not the war they want.
The old woman leaned forward, her black eyes gleaming.
I think that Red Willow has more worshippers in this city than all the other gods together. Have you heard Benero preach?
Last night.
Benero can see the morrow in his flames, the widow said. Triarch Malaquo tried to hire the Golden Company, did you know? He meant to clean out the Red Temple and put Benero to the sword. He dare not use tiger cloaks. Half of them worship the Lord of Light as well. Oh, these are dire days in old Valentis, even for wrinkled old widows. But not half so dire as in Meereen, I think. So tell me, sir, why do you seek the Silver Queen?
That is my concern. I can pay for our passage, and pay well. I have the silver.
Fool, thought Tyrion. It's not coin she wants, it's respect. Haven't you heard a word, she said.
He glanced back over his shoulder again. The dwarf had moved closer to their table,
and he seemed to have a knife in his hand. The hairs on the back of his neck began to prickle.
Keep your silver, I have gold, and spare me your black look, sir. I'm too old to be frightened of a skull. You are a hard man, I see, and no doubt skilled with that long sword at your side. But this is my realm. Let me crook a finger, and you may find yourself travelling through Meereen, chained to an oar in the belly of a galley.
She lifted her jade fan and opened it. There was a rustle of leaves, and a man slid from the overgrown archway to her left. His face was a mass of scars, and in one hand he held a sword, short and heavy as a cleaver.
Seek the widow of the waterfront, someone told you. But they should have also warned you, beware the widow's sons. It is such a sweet morning, though, I shall ask again. Why would you seek Daenerys Targaryen, whom half the world wants dead?
Jorah Mormont's face was dark with anger, but he answered, to serve her, defend her, die for her, if need be. That made the widow laugh.
You want to rescue her? Is that the way of it? Far more enemies than I can name, with swords beyond count. This is what you have the poor widow believe, that you are a true and chivalrous Westerosi knight, crossing half the world to come to the aid of this, she's no maiden, though she may still be fair.
She laughed again.
Do you think your dwarf will please her? Will she bathe in his blood, do you think, or content herself with striking off his head?
Sir Jorah hesitated. The dwarf is...
I know who the dwarf is, and what he is.
Her black eyes turned to Tyrion, hard as stone.
Kinslayer, Kingslayer, murderer, turncloak, Lannister.
She made the last a curse.
What do you plan to offer the Dragon Queen, little man?
My hate, Tyrion wanted to say. Instead, he spread his hands as far as the fetters would allow.
Whatever she would have of me. Sage counsel, savage wit, a bit of tumbling, my cock if she desires it, my tongue if she does not. I will lead her armies or rub her feet as she desires. And the only reward I ask is I might be allowed to rape and kill my sister.
That brought the smile back to the old woman's face.
This one, at least, is honest, she announced. But you, sir, I have known a dozen Westerosi knights and 1,000 adventurers of the same ilk, but none so pure as you would paint yourself. Men are beasts, selfish and brutal. However gentle the words, there are always darker motives underneath. I do not trust you, sir.
She flicked them off with her fan, as if they were no more than flies buzzing about her head.
If you want to get to Meereen, swim. I have no help to give you.
Then 7 hells broke out at once. Sir Jorah started to rise. The widow snapped her fan close. Her scarred man slid out of the shadows. And behind them, a girl screamed. Tyrion spun just in time to see the dwarf rushing toward him.
She is a girl, he realized all at once. A girl dressed up in man's clothes. And she means to gut me with that knife.
For half a heartbeat, Sir Jorah, the widow, and the scarred man stood still as stone. Idlers watched from nearby tables, sipping ale and wine, but no one moved to interfere. Tyrion had to move both hands at once, but his chains had just enough give for him to reach the flagon on the table. He closed his fist around it, spun, dashed its contents into the face of the charging dwarf girl, then threw himself to one side to avoid her knife. The flagon shattered underneath him as the floor came up to smack him in the head. Then the girl was on him once again. Tyrion rolled to one side as she buried the knife blade in the floorboards, yanked it free, raised it again. And suddenly she was rising off the floor, legs kicking wildly as she struggled in Ser Jorah's grasp.
"No,"
she wailed in the common tongue of Westeros.
"Let go!"
Tyrion heard her tunic rip as she fought to free herself. Mormont had her by the collar with one hand. With the other, he wrenched the dagger from her grasp. "Enough!" The landlord made his appearance then, a cudgel in his hand, but when he saw the broken flagon, he uttered a blistering curse and demanded to know what had happened here. "Dwarf fight," replied the Tyrushi with a purple beard, chuckling. Tyrion blinked up at the dripping girl twisting in the air. "Why?" he demanded. "What did I ever do to you?"
"They killed him."
All the fight went out of her at that. She hung limply in Mormon's grasp as her eyes filled with tears.
"My brother, they took him, and they killed him."
"Who killed him?" asked Mormont.
"Sailors. Sailors from the Seven Kingdoms. There were five of them, drunk. They saw us jousting in the square and followed us. When they realized I was a girl, they let me go, but they took my brother and killed him. They cut his head off."
Tyrion felt a sudden shock of recognition. "They saw us jousting in the square?" He knew who the girl was then.
"Did you ride the pig," he asked her, "or the dog?" "The dog," she sobbed. "Uppo always rode the pig."
The dwarfs from Joffrey's wedding. It was their show that had started all the trouble that night. How strange to encounter them again half a world away, though perhaps not so strange as that. If they'd had half the wits of their pig, they would have fled King's Landing the night Joff died, before Cersei could assign them some share of blame in her son's death. "Let her down, sir," he told Ser Jorah Mormont. "She won't do us any harm." Ser Jorah dumped the dwarf girl on the floor. "I'm sorry for your brother, but we had no part in his murder."
"He did."
The girl pushed herself to her knees, clutching her torn, wine-drenched tunic to small, pale breasts.
"It was him they wanted. They thought Uppo was him."
The girl was weeping, begging for help from anyone who would listen.
"He should die, the way my poor brother died. Please, someone help me. Someone kill him."
The landlord seized her roughly by one arm and wrenched her back to her feet, shouting in Volantine, demanding to know who was going to pay for this damage. The widow of the waterfront gave Mormont a cool look.
"Knights defend the weak and protect the innocent, they say. And I am the fairest maid in all Valantis."
Her laugh was full of scorn.
"What do they call you, child?"
"Penny."
The old woman called out to the landlord in the tongue of old Valantis. Tyrion knew enough to understand that she was telling him to take the dwarf girl up to her rooms, give her wine, and find some clothes for her to wear. When they were gone, the widow studied Tyrion, her black eyes shining.
"Monsters should be larger, it seems to me. You're worth a lordship back in Westeros, little man. Here, I fear, your worth is somewhat less. But I think I'd best help you after all. Valantis is no safe place for dwarfs, it seems."
"You are too kind." Tyrion gave her his sweetest smile.
"Perhaps you would be so kind as to remove these charming iron bracelets as well. This monster has but half a nose, and it itches most abominably. The chains are too short for me to scratch it. I'll make you a gift of them, and gladly."
"How generous! But I have worn iron in my time, and now I find that I prefer gold and silver. And sad to say, this is Valantis, where fetters and chains are cheaper than day-old bread, and it is forbidden to help a slave escape."
"I'm no slave." "Oh, every man ever taken by slavers sings that same sad song.
I dare not help you. Here.
She leaned forward again.
2 days from now, the cog, Serasori Corran, will set sail for Kark by way of New Gith, carrying tin and iron, bales of wool and lace, 50 Mirish carpets, a corpse pickled in brine, 20 jars of dragon peppers, and a red priest. Be on her when she sails.
We will, said Tyrion, and thank you. Sir Jorah frowned.
Karth is not our destination. She will never reach Karth, but Nero has seen it in his fires.
The crone smiled, a vulpine smile. As you say, Tyrion grinned, if I were Valentine and free and had the blood, you'd have my vote for Treyarch, my lady.
I'm no lady, the widow replied, just Volgaro's whore. You'll want to be gone from here before the tigers come. Should you reach your queen, give her a message from the slaves of old Volantis.
She touched the faded scar upon her wrinkled cheek, where her tears had been cut away.
Tell her we are waiting. Tell her to come soon.